chickens in the houses, they got chickens in the trees, chicken in the pots, the Mottawog, the Petaloomies, out in Petaluma, spending my days. Oh, I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Tell me, how many eggs will a chicken lay? Now Marvin got me started, sold me my first hen. Now I got 4 and 20, and 24 more again. I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Oh, I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Tell me, how many eggs will a chicken lay? Chicken in the morning, it's chicken in the night. Weren't for chicken, Petaluma never would have reached its height. I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Oh, I'm out in Petaluma, spending my days. Tell me, how many eggs will a chicken lay?
Welcome to Mouthful Smart Talk about food, wine, and farming here in Sonoma County and beyond. And we are going beyond and back, to quote Hillary Culhane's show title, great show on Friday nights. We're going to Canada, then we're coming back to Sonoma County. And there's just one guest in the studio. We have one pre-recorded, and we have one live, and that's me. If you're new to Mouthful, I come on by myself. You know, I used to want to do it once a year, and there's just so many great people to talk to that I ended up doing about once every 2 to 3 years. Try to hit each of the seasons in that time, because, you know, I have a lot to say, and I'm out and about a lot. I like to take calls when I'm doing this show, but I'm really not that happy with the sonic quality that we're getting from the telephone here. So instead of, you know, risking going off the rails by not being able to hear the call, here's what we can do. If you're on Facebook, Mouthful has a page. It's Mouthful Smart Talk about food, wine, and farming. You can just go to that page if you have a question pops up as I'm talking. It can be a question about anything somewhat relevant to the season, to Sonoma County, to cooking in the summer, and anything else that we talk about. So I've got it open on my computer right in front of me, Mouthful Smart Talk about food, wine, and farming on Facebook. And I will answer whatever questions are posted. So that's one thing we can do. We're going to start out. I'm going to talk first about eggs. And then we're going to hear from Dr. Navindra Siram. We spoke with him on April 2nd, the day after he had hosted the first annual scientific symposium on maple syrup in San Francisco. And he and the publicist for Canadian maple syrup got in touch with me on Thursday or Friday. He had a bunch of ideas for using maple syrup over the July 4th holiday. And because he is so articulate, I said, absolutely, let's tape a conversation. He's a very generous man with his knowledge, and he just seems to love life. So we'll be hearing him from him in just a few minutes, and I'll let you know when. But first, we're going to talk a little bit about eggs, because it has been a real egg day for me. And I'm just going to tell you that story and to encourage you, even though it's much more expensive in the short run, to buy eggs from a neighbor, a farmer at the farmer's market, or at another location. The eggs from happy chickens who spend a lot of their time in the sun are so much, first, they taste so much better. And those national reporters who tell you that buying more expensive eggs from happy chickens is an act of faith because there's no difference in taste. The people who say that don't have taste buds. They must be non-tasters, because in my experience, once you have had a really great egg, there's no comparison. You can't go back to supermarket eggs, the kind that run anywhere, $3 a dozen or less, and even up to $4 a dozen. Those chickens are living in unhappy quarters. They are, for the most part, there's even a way that you can say cage-free, and the chickens are still in much too crowded conditions. In Sonoma County, we have fabulous, fabulous eggs. They will run you anywhere from $5 to $11 a dozen. But one thing to know is, first of all, the nutrition is better. Second of all, the satisfaction levels just can't be compared. You know, if you make a 3-egg omelet out of supermarket eggs, in certain ways, you're never going to be satisfied with that. I now make omelets at home using, if they're a big egg, I use one egg. And if they're a little egg, say from a bantam hen, and I have some of those, I might use two. And all I do is I have a little salt, a little pepper, butter to cook it in, maybe a little hot sauce, maybe a tiny bit of good cheese, but I don't do a lot of filling. It's so healthy, and it's so delicious, you don't need anything else. So I've been out of eggs for about a week, and it's my fault, but I won't go to the supermarket and get them. So here's what I did first this afternoon. I went out to Rose and Thorn. It is on Highway 12 on the way to the town of Bodega, or Freestone, whatever you want to think. It's about 3 miles past downtown Sebastopol. It's before you get to Bill's Farm Basket. So if you're headed west and you see Bill's Farm Basket, you've gone too far. It's on the south side of the road, and it sells everything from Carol Kohler Dark, I think. I'm sorry if I got your name wrong, Carol. She has used clothing. She has beautiful new tablecloths, gorgeous earrings, whimsical and practical things for your garden, plants to take home. She has a beautiful deep red pelargonium, some in little $5 pots right now. Tchotchkes, there's a gorgeous chicken coop. Gorgeous. I think it would probably hold about at least 6, maybe even up to 10 hens, built out of recycled wood, $600. If you have a place to keep chickens, it's fabulous. But she also has a chicken compound. That's the only thing I can think of to call it. There are several buildings. I think most are attached to each other. One looks like a geodesic dome. One looks like a little castle. And she has so many different breeds scattered throughout this chicken compound, which all the pathways are lined with fresh straw, dried straw, but nice and fresh. It's not yucky or anything. And the chickens roam free in that area. And dogs are welcome, but you have to have them on a leash, because you know what a dog will do with a chicken that is running. It will chase it, as Lark tried to do. The chickens are so entertaining. The best way to see them is to find a spot and then just sit quietly. And eventually they'll get over, oh, who's that stranger? And they'll just start doing their chicken thing of walking around. And there are solid black ones with crazy top knots, and colorful ones, and little tiny ones, and big, huge ones. And you can just sit there in the shade and watch chickens. They're just spectacular. So I was able to get 12.5 eggs from her. $9 for a dozen and a half of these extremely happy chicken eggs. Interestingly, her chickens have already started to molt. I think of chickens molting a little bit later when both the days are noticeably shorter. That's why they molt. They typically molt in response to cooling temperatures and the shortening of daylight. But her, she says, right when she wants a lot of eggs, they start to molt. So production is down. She is taking special orders by phone. But it's just, even if you don't get eggs on any particular day, if you haven't been to Rose and Thorn, it is one of the very special places in Sonoma County. Absolutely wonderful. I also went on an adventure to a part of Santa Rosa I haven't been in, South Santa Rosa, and traded a bottle of Sonoma County Drinkable for 3 dozen eggs from Happy Chickens. And you'll see all over Sonoma County, you will see signs that say eggs with a sign, say, pointing down a driveway. Some have honor system sales booths where if they're egg, you know, you might see a sign that says chicken, the chickens are in, and you go and you get your eggs and you leave money in a lockbox. It's, you know, a lot of people talk about how much Sonoma County is changing and how much of our agricultural identity that we're losing. And of course, that is absolutely true, especially if you never get off the 101 corridor. That's very apparent. But there are more egg stands than I can count. And I really, really encourage you to visit them. They make spectacular deviled eggs, something that I love. They're great in potato salad. A simple poached egg for breakfast on top of congee or not is a great way to start your morning. So that's my message to you for, that's my first message to you today, is get the best local eggs you can. And honestly, I think you will be very happy if you're not already doing that. And you know, if you're still of the mind that eggs are bad for you, that's been disproven. Eggs have all of the necessary amino acids required for human health. They are one of the world's perfect foods. And I got a really odd email from someone who had read a column I wrote in the Press Democrat about eggs. And every now and then I get something like this from a vegan. And there's this myth that is going around, seems to be going through that segment of the population, that chicken eggs are a product of a chicken's menstruation. And why would you want to eat that? First of all, chickens are not mammals. They're birds, and it's a whole different biological system. And chickens, once they reach maturity, or actually a little bit younger, once they become pullets, which is sort of like late teenage years, chickens lay eggs. Most chickens lay eggs, would lay an egg every 26 to 28 hours. And it does so throughout its lifetime. Once it gets a little older, once it gets past, say, 2.5, 3 years, some chickens produce fewer eggs at that time. But I know if you remember Nancy Skull of Middleton Farm, she's been gone about 1.5 years now, passed away in her 80s. She had chickens who were 11 and 12 years old, her girls. She loved her chickens, and she would bring, whenever she had eggs, she would bring them to the farmer's market. And sometimes she'd sell them, but sometimes she'd just slip half a dozen to one of her favorite customers. And I was lucky to get those eggs a few times, and they were absolutely delicious. So it has nothing to do with the human reproductive cycle. Chickens do not have a uterus that sheds its lining every month as humans do. An egg is the product of a chicken throughout its lifetime. What you get if you have a rooster involved is you get fertilized eggs. And those aren't the eggs that you crack open and you see say, a little bit of blood, which happens every now and then, that's not a fertilized egg. A fertilized egg, you can see, because there'll be a dot, just a little dot on the yolk, and it's perfectly fine to eat. There's no problem with it. But if you have chickens within the city limits, you're probably not going to have a rooster, because it's illegal to have roosters in the city limits. In fact, if you have a rooster, somebody might call and turn you in, because they're thought to be too noisy too early in the morning. So it's not legal to have roosters in the city limits. So if you're buying eggs in the city limits, they're not going to be fertilized. And a lot of people don't keep roosters. Some do, some don't. Some hens are really unhappy if they don't have a rooster around. And it's very interesting to watch their pecking order, because when there is a rooster and the hens like the rooster, when they put themselves to bed at night, which they do on their own, and they'll have their chicken coop with their railings where they sit, the rooster, after he rounds up his girls, he sits on the top, if you're facing it, on the far left. That's the premier position. The hen at the top of the pecking order sits next to him, and it descends in that way to, on the bottom rung on the far right, is the chicken, the hen who is on, who is the lowest one on the pecking order. It's fascinating. I love watching that. Some hens, however, don't really like having roosters around. I noticed on Facebook earlier today that someone is trying to rehome this beautiful rooster, mostly a blackbird. He's about a year old, and he needs a new home because the hens hate him. They don't want the rooster around. Get this guy out of here. So that's your little chicken lesson. Hope you enjoyed it. And again, I invite you, if you have any questions or comments, just go to Facebook and leave them at Mouthful Smart Talk About Food, Wine, and Farming. I'm looking right at it. So, and another thing you can do if you want is tell us if you're making anything special for the holiday. Like to hear what people are doing, especially if it's something a little bit different. But if you have a tradition, tell us about it on Facebook, and I'll talk about it on the air. We're going to shift topics now, and we're going to get ready to do the interview with Dr. Siram. I always want to say Siram, and I think it's Siram. He's talking about maple syrup. He's talking about some ways to use maple syrup over the holiday. Those recipes, I will have links to them on the Mouthful Facebook page by the end of this evening. I also want to put some pictures, and I was waiting to get some photographs from them, on michelleannajordan.com. So he talks about using it in coleslaw, as a glaze, and also, which I really like and I'm going to be trying soon, in cocktails. So let's hear from Dr. Siram.
Welcome to Mouthful, Dr. Siram. How are you today?
Fine. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Oh, you bet. I loved when you were on just, oh gosh, I guess it's been about 3 months ago when you were out to the Bay Area for the conference.
Yes.
Could you tell us just real quickly a summary about that conference, because it was the first of its kind, and I find it really interesting.
Right. That was the first ever global one-day symposium focused entirely on maple research. It was at the American Chemical Society Spring National Meeting in San Francisco on April 2nd.
And how many people attended?
Well, I looked at a room. I remember the room had a seating for about 70 people. And there were folks standing up. So
okay, I think it's interesting that there's this growing focus on maple syrup these days. I think it's a wonderful development.
Yes, and I think in part it's because it's such a niche North American crop, agricultural crop that's only produced in eastern North America, primarily in Canada and Quebec, and also in the United States and the New England states.
Before we get to the specific tips you have for us for 4th of July, I'm curious about the best way to get Canadian maple syrup if we want it. Is the importing of that a pretty seamless, easy thing, and we can generally find it in our markets?
Absolutely. So although the U.S. produces maple syrup, we largely import from Canada also. You know, you could also go to purecanadamaple.com, the website, and you'll be able to find where you could get the product from.
Okay, excellent. And I know that most people, I think if you were to take 100 people at random and say maple syrup, they would say pancakes or waffles in response. But you've really broadened that, and so you've certainly broadened it for this upcoming holiday on Tuesday. Why don't you tell us some of the ideas you have?
Right, Michelle. So we want to let people know that they should think beyond the topping. This natural sweetener, which is so full of unique flavor, the maple flavor, should not only go on your pancakes. You know, you could use this to sweeten your coffee and your tea and so on. But I think because of July and summer is fastly approaching and, you know, it's grilling season, we wanted people to expand the use of maple syrup and kind of think outside of the box or outside of the topping, where, you know, you could use maple syrup in different types of marinades for your barbecue. You could make different steaks or chicken or pork glazed with maple flavoring. You could even use your vegetables. You know, my wife liked to do sweet potatoes, and she would actually put a little bit of drizzle of maple syrup on it.
Sweet potatoes with maple syrup, that is a match made in botanical heaven. I like to make a very simple sweet potato salad and then dress it with maple syrup and bacon vinaigrette.
Yes,
it is really good.
Yeah, and maple coleslaw, you know, you may never think
about yes, maple coleslaw too. Mm.
There you go. So, and then, of course, you know, I have a nice cocktail with my wife.
I was going to ask you about cocktails. Tell us about that.
Oh, gosh. So drink responsibly to begin with. But, you know,
of course.
A little twist of maple in some of my favorite Caribbean rum. I'm from the Caribbean. You know, I've tried it for my friends in different type of cocktails. A nice hint of maybe combining it with lemon, a nice twist. But you get that sweet and that sour flavoring all together. It's an amazing food when you think about maple syrup, which is produced by boiling the sap from the trees, and there are no additives.
Mm-hmm.
So you create the unique flavor and odor of maple syrup during the cooking. It's like caramelization, like you cook any other food because of the natural sugars present in the food itself. But, you know, you have sucrose for sure. It's a sweetener. But then you have this unique combination of vitamins and minerals and amino acids and a lot of phytochemicals that you find in other healthy plant foods. Really,
you know, you read these days a lot in sort of mainstream news and on mainstream websites all about you need to cut sugar 100% out of your diet. And I think a lot of people have this, like, secret guilt about eating sugar. Where does maple syrup fit into that whole discussion?
Right, so just to back up a little bit, you know, we were taught that all fats were bad, and then we said, hey,
exactly.
Olive oil is a good fat. I believe that humans were hardwired for sweetness, for taste, and it's because sugar is our primary source of energy, carbohydrates. And, you know, of course, we want to let people know that no sweetener should ever be used in excess. Everything has to be used in moderation, just like every other food. But I think within the category of sweeteners, you know, when I reach to give my kids toppings on their pancakes, I prefer to use the pure natural product, maple, rather than pancake syrup, which, you know, is high fructose corn syrup sometimes with artificial flavoring. Mm-hmm. Similarly, you know, when we're choosing a sweetener because of the unique combination of its cocktail of natural compounds and flavor molecules and amino acids and minerals, again, as I said before, you know, I think within that category of sweeteners, I believe it's a healthier choice.
And I think it's a great, I look at it as a gift of nature.
Exactly, because, you know, it's the sap is like the lifeblood of the trees, and the Native Americans, the indigenous people, were using this as a medicinal tonic for centuries before the Europeans came. This is a very true agricultural crop that's indigenous to Eastern North America. The settlers, when they came, they just kind of improvised ways of getting more sap and how to boil it. But it's really been around for centuries.
It's interesting to think about how it was first discovered. I always envision someone walking by and seeing something dripping from a tree and just reaching out their finger and tasting it.
Exactly. And there are different stories that we hear about frozen sap, and the Native Americans would actually take baskets, and then they would collect sap, and then they would have hot rocks, heat the rocks, put it in to kind of evaporate off the sap, and then they'll get to something that's sweeter. And interestingly enough, maple sugar played a very important role in the fight against slavery, since cane sugar.
Really?
Yes. Cane sugar was associated with slavery for sure, labor.
Mm-hmm.
During that time of the abolitionists, maple sugar was really heavily promoted this part of the world and actually widely utilized. I mean, it's kind of flipped the syrup being more consumed than sugar, but maple sugar also available, and that's another useful ingredient, an amazing ingredient that people
should. Yeah, it's wonderful.
Wonderful, wonderful. The flavor.
Okay. Maple sugar. And then let's see, I think you have sent us some recipes, I believe. Japanese style skirt steak, maple grilled corn, and a maple coleslaw. We're going to put those up on Mouthful's Facebook page, and I'm also going to do a little story about this on my website as well. So that will be up well before the holiday.
Wonderful, Michelle, and please let the listeners know that they can check out purecanadamaple.com for additional grilling tips and other recipes.
That sounds just great. And thank you again. And Dr. Saram, you have an open invitation to Mouthful anytime you feel like talking to us about maple syrup.
Thank you so much, Michelle. Have a nice summer. Enjoy your barbecuing, okay?
And you too as well.
Okay, we're back. Thanks so much to Dr. Saram. He is just wonderful. I want to have a meal with him sometime. When you're shopping for maple syrup, I usually get mine, I've gotten most of mine at Oliver's Markets. I typically buy grade B. I like the flavor. It's a little bit pricey, but like those eggs from Happy Chickens, a little bit goes a long, long way. I remember, pouring like lots of, what is it, Aunt Jemima's pancake syrup or something, which is really just high fructose corn syrup seasoned with, I think, brown sugar and vanilla. It takes a lot to satisfy you, but pure maple syrup, you just don't need much, and it just tastes so absolutely delicious. So there you go, maple syrup, something fun. And those recipes will be up on Mouthful's Facebook page. Let's give myself a break and say, if not tonight, by early tomorrow. And I'll also have something up on my my website as well. And I'll probably do a couple of my own recipes as well. I do a sweet potato salad with warm bacon and maple syrup vinaigrette. Mm-mm-mm. It is so very good. What do we want to talk about next? Let's talk about gazpacho. There was a long thread, again, I don't spend all my time on Facebook, honest, but there was a long thread about what is gazpacho really on a food writer's page. And it was an interesting discussion. In America, it is very much like tomato juice with a bunch of chopped vegetables in it. In fact, if you go online, and you really have to be careful going online for recipes. I've probably warned you about that before, but I'll warn you about it again. You don't know, unless it's a website that really explains who is talking to you, who is posting that information. You don't know if the recipes have been tested. You don't know if the recipes work. And every now and then, if I'm working on some sort of column about a dish that's very, very popular, I might just explore internet recipes to see what people are being told. And I'll tell you, more often than not, I find recipes that absolutely will not work. I can read a recipe and tell you if it will work or not. I also find a lot of recipes that use shortcuts. I've seen gazpacho where it calls for a can of V8 juice, and then you chop up a bunch of vegetables, and there you have your gazpacho. Gazpacho goes back to Andalusia in Spain several hundred years before tomatoes had made their way from the New World to Europe. It had nothing to do whatsoever with tomatoes. It was a thrifty food. It was designed to use every last bit of the breadcrumbs off that precious loaf of bread, along with garlic, vinegar, olive oil, and water. If you had if you were a little bit more well off, you might grind some almonds and put some almonds in there. That would give it some structure. And as it developed, at some point, someone began putting white grapes on top of it, preferably sliced white grapes on top. The exact recipe for the very first gazpacho is disputed, but no one disputes that it originated in Andalusia and was made up of those basic ingredients. Sopa de ajo. You still see, I write about it in my Press Democrat column. I think I did that fairly recently in early June when I did a column on garlic. But you still see lots of versions. Over the years, over the decades, it became very popular in America to make it with a base of tomatoes. It got popular in the 1950s, early 1960s. If you remember the dinner party in Mad Men, I think it was the third season, it might have been the fourth season of Mad Men, when they're working on the Heineken campaign, and Betty Draper buys Heineken for this dinner party and then gets angry because she feels like she's been set up and embarrassed. The Heineken displays in these few test markets were done by Sterling Cooper to see if they could get housewives to buy beer. And in fact, they did. She served ramaki, which is chicken livers wrapped in bacon and grilled. And she served gazpacho. There was one other dish, and I don't remember what it is. But she served gazpacho, and it was very much a tomato gazpacho. And there's nothing wrong with tomato gazpacho at all. It can be very delicious. Now is the time to make it. The very first, as far as I know, first tomatoes grown in the ground in Sonoma County. Not hydroponic, because we have hydroponic tomatoes typically starting in January, sometimes in February. But the first tomatoes grown in the ground and not in a hothouse We're at the farmer's market this weekend. They're from The Patch. The Patch is a farm in the town of Sonoma, a little bit east of downtown. They have this unique little microclimate, and the microclimate is so micro that, and it's not very big, it's like 2 or 3 acres, I don't think it's much bigger than that, but there are microclimates within that little microclimate, so that if he plants his tomatoes in one place, they ripen way sooner than if they ripen in the other part of the property. So Lazaro, wonderful man, everyone who works with him is wonderful. He had the first tomatoes of the season at the farmer's market this weekend. They should start coming on pretty strong now. They like steady, warm heat. They don't like anything over about 90 degrees, and they get mushy if they're grown where temperatures drop below 58 degrees for more than a couple of hours. That's one of the reasons I don't really grow tomatoes very well at my house in Sebastopol, because we do sometimes have those cold nights. So I'm happy to buy tomatoes from my local farmers. So what should you know about gazpacho and about making it at home? Number one, you should know that it's easy. It's very easy. You don't need to go to a restaurant to enjoy really good gazpacho. The other thing is, you need to ignore every recipe that tells you to use a blender, a food processor, or even an immersion blender. Do not do it. What happens when you do that is any of those devices incorporate air into the tomatoes. And if you're going to make a different type of cold soup, sometimes called gazpacho, like what I call my watermelon soup, watermelon gazpacho, has no tomatoes in it. But same thing, do not use any mechanical device to break down the fruit or the vegetable, because what happens when air is incorporated, you get foam. And if you've known me for 5 minutes, you know how I feel about foam. Foam is awful, especially in foods where you don't want it. And I can't imagine anyone wants it in a gazpacho. It adds a cushion in your tongue, which is unpleasant. But it's also, it's just kind of yucky, and you miss some of the flavors. You can chop your tomatoes. It's very, and let's back up a little bit. You have to peel your tomatoes for gazpacho. Especially the ones that are going to form the soup base, they need to be peeled. So another piece of advice that nearly every chef gives you, and most online recipes also give you, is you drop the tomato into boiling water. Some say 10 seconds, some say 30 seconds. Never, ever do this. It is wrong. Never do it, please. Mama Michelle doesn't want you to do it, and your life will improve if you don't. So here is what you do. And you can do this whether you have a gas burner, an electric burner, or one of those glass top things. You just have to get a burner really hot. With gas, that means high flame. With electric, it means, you know, putting it on high and leaving it until it turns red. Then you set your tomatoes up, however many you're going to do, and you get a dinner fork. Don't use your best silver. Just get your, in fact, don't use silver at all, because it will react with the acid in the tomatoes. But just get a fork with long tines, like a dinner fork. Push that through the stem end of the tomato, not the blossom end, which is just that little bump, but the stem end, the core. Push the fork in. When the burner's hot, hold the tomato right over the burner. You can put it directly into the flame if you're using gas, and rotate it slowly. It takes anywhere from 15 to 45 seconds. Tomatoes that are grown by backyard farmers, by farmers around here, anywhere, they tend to have thinner skins than commercial tomatoes. So you have to watch, and you'll hear, if you don't have music on, you'll hear the skin pop. And that's what you're looking for. It pops, and you just rotate that tomato, and then you set it down on your work surface or in a bowl or something, and you do all your tomatoes. And, you know, you can do more than a dozen in 3 or 4 minutes. And by the time you're done with the last tomato, that first one will have cooled enough that you can peel the skin. And all that should happen is you use your fingernails and just pull off that skin. It should just pull right off, and it doesn't take any of the flesh with it. If you're working with supermarket tomatoes, if you're working with commercial tomatoes, it's going to take a little bit longer to hear that crack. And you might have to tug at it a little bit more or even use a vegetable peeler. And that's because the skins are thicker. And they're thicker because they have to be transported great distances and they have to have a shelf life. So that's why they've been bred to be like that. So very quickly, you just want to take off those skins, throw the skins away. They're not really good for anything. And then what you want to do next is get yourself a deep bowl and a strainer. Set the strainer on top. Cut your tomatoes in half through the equator. Not through the poles, through the equator. We all know what that means, don't we? Don't we? Anthony's nodding, so we do. And then hold the tomato cut side down and squeeze. That's going to get out all the gel and all of the seeds. If you were to cut it through the poles, that would only open up a couple of the pockets. So the reason that you're cutting through the equator is that opens up all the pockets. You might have to use your little finger to encourage some of those seeds and gel, some of the seeds and gel to come out. So when you're done with that, add a couple pinches of salt, stir it, and set it aside. And what you're going to have is you're going to have some really nice juice that has come out of those seed pockets. It's really delicious. You can put it in your gazpacho if you want. You can use it to make a really delicate tomato vinaigrette, or you can pop it in the refrigerator, and once you're done making your gazpacho, sit back and have a really nice Bloody Mary with fresh tomato juice. Okay, so we've got that part done. Now what you want to do is you want to get rid of those cores, the stem and core, and you could have done that before you cut them in half, or you can do it later. And just every now and then, as you're chopping what's left of the flesh, reach over and stir the seeds, because you're going to have that juice just continuing to drop down into the strainer. So chop your tomatoes. Use a good broad chef's knife and hold the handle in your dominant hand, and then put the knife down in the pile of tomatoes. Put your hand on top of the end of the blade and chop that way. Up and down. Don't slice. Chop. And you want to move those tomatoes into as small pieces as possible. And by this time, the seeds are probably drained. So you put those seeds into your compost. You put the strainer back on top of the bowl. And then you scoop up all the tomatoes and the juice. And you put them into the bowl, add another pinch of salt, and stir it a little bit. And then just, you know, go have that Bloody Mary or prep the rest of the food that you're going to have. And then at that point, in the bowl, you have wonderful tomato juice. You can use it neat, just like it is, to form the base of a gazpacho. Or you can add an equal amount of stock. Chicken stock is really, really lovely. Homemade chicken stock is lovely in certain types of gazpacho. And then if you want substance, you take those chopped tomatoes that have now dried out, and this is going to solve a mystery. Those chopped tomatoes that have been drained, that's called tomato concassé. And you often see that in chef's recipes without an explanation. And I know one time when I was, before I was writing for the Press Democrat, I'd just been really getting a bit of a local name here. The food editor at the time, who didn't have a food background, he took over the food page because he got really tired of going to games by himself. He'd been a sports writer and he got sick of going to games by himself. So he had gotten some recipes from a chef who went on to become very famous. But the chef was so intimidating that he didn't have the nerve to ask him what tomato concassé was. And so he called me up and I said, oh, those chefs, they should just tell you. So that's what tomato concassé is. It's just part of every chef's mise en place, which is putting things in place before the restaurant opens. And, you know, it's a great ingredient. You can use that to make salsa so that you don't have a watery salsa, or you can stir it back into all those lovely juices for a thicker soup. And at that point, it's really up to you how you season it, what other foods you put in. Sometimes I'll press in a clove of garlic. I might chop up some serranos or some other hot pepper. If it's 100 degrees, I'm probably going to dice up a couple of cucumbers after I seed them and put those in, because at that point you're eating to cool yourself off. But that's the base of really good gazpacho. You can add diced zucchini, you can add a green onion, you can add chopped red onion, you can tear up basil and put basil in. If you use a hot chili, I recommend that you also put in some cilantro, because those two things go together really well. And then you need to taste it. And when you're tasting it, what are you looking for? You're looking for balance, you're looking for it to taste really good, and you're looking for it not to be flat. And flat just really means that the flavors haven't blossomed yet. And there's two ways to fix this. Some tomatoes are really low acid. And if you get a tomato that's tomatoes for tomato soup that's really low acid, you might want to add a squeeze of either lemon juice, or if you're going the Mexican route with hot chilies and cilantro, some lime juice. That will perk it up. If it's still flat after you add those, it needs a little bit more salt. Salt makes all flavors blossom. You can then put it in a bowl or a cup and serve it, or, and this is what I really like to do, get your very best olive oil and drizzle a little bit of that really good olive oil on each portion and top it with some nice ground pepper, and there you have a fabulous gazpacho. I have these recipes on my website, michelleannajordan.com, and I'll have more up soon. They're also in my book, The Good Cook's Book of Tomatoes, which I just learned, hooray, has made back its advance. 95% of books published never make back their advance. So even though the advance was minuscule, it still feels like an accomplishment. And you know, I can talk so much, we're not even going to have time to play music. So I'm going to have a little more music and come back and talk about zucchini.
Have to turn sideways to get through the door.
rock pile, knife and fork. Kind of patronizing, but it's a good song. And before that, that little 11-second snippet was Welcome to Der Wiener Schnitzel by The Descendants, something that never fails to make me laugh. So I should say that I am the guest tonight. We are talking, and this is something that I've wanted to do more of, and maybe I will. Because, you know, I spend so much of my time studying food, researching food, writing about food, that I have lots and lots of topics. And I'm absolutely passionate about the seasons. Really, really, really passionate about the seasons, sometimes ridiculously so. This year, I've broken one of my biggest vows, and that's for the last decade, probably, I have not eaten watermelon until watermelon is ripe in Sonoma County, which typically means September, maybe late August. But something, you may have seen this, because there's a lot of information out about it now, most likely thanks to the Watermelon Council. But whoever gives us this information, it's fine. Watermelon is so good for you. It is one of the best things you can eat or drink. And as when I was so sick with norovirus throughout much of June, so I ate nothing for 12 days. I lived on watermelon juice. It has all of the electrolytes that we need. And that's what happens when you have gastroenteritis. The risk is you might get dehydrated and your electrolytes might be off balance. And I've actually lost two friends. They died because of electrolyte imbalances. So watermelon is a really, really good thing to know about. And there's actually a couple of brands now in the supermarket if you're not able to cook or prepare anything as I wasn't. So watermelon, I've made an exception when it comes to local food this year because I really needed watermelon. But one of the things you'll notice, and you know, we may not even get to, I wanted to do quite a bit about farmers markets. We may only be able to touch on two tonight, might talk about more about our local farmers markets next week. But one of the things we've been seeing since late March is the first zucchini. And now we are in the abundant season of zucchini. And I have a lot of recipes for zucchini on my website, michelleannajordan.com, and I will be putting more up. But just a few things you can do. You can cut zucchini into noodles, especially if you're gluten-free. You can just use zucchini noodles. You'll need a little mandoline. Look it up. It's an inexpensive kitchen device. You make noodles about the same size as spaghetti. They can be cooked or not. They don't have to be cooked. You can put standard tomato sauces on them, or you can dress them. I like to dress them with garlic, lemon juice, fresh cumin, some olive oil. Really refreshing. Another thing you can do, and I've been doing this a lot the last few days, make zucchini tacos. Just chop up. I like things to be even when I'm chopping, because I think our body perceives uniformity, not just with our eyes, but with our palates, with our fingers. So I cut quarter-inch squares of zucchini, and I like smaller zucchini, so there's a greater ratio of skin because I like the flavor of the skin. Sauté it. I need about not quite half a cup. I sauté it in a little olive oil, some ground cumin, a little bit of garlic. Add in lemon. Some lemon juice. I keep lemon juice in the freezer so that I can just grab a little bit if I don't have any lemons around. Salt. Two warm tortillas. Don't get them crispy. Grate a little cheese with this. I like a nice white cheddar. Put that on one of the tortillas on top of the other tortilla. Tip the sauteed zucchini on top and you might add your favorite salsa. I've been doing a green salsa, which I really like with zucchini. And there you have a fabulous lunch, a fabulous dinner, and you've used some of your zucchini. You can do it for yourself alone. You can make it for your family. I've had people look at me like, oh God, zucchini tacos, are you kidding? And then they love them, including my grandson. He loves them. Very quickly, moving on to farmers markets. This Tuesday, July 4th, sometimes farmers markets are canceled on holidays. The Forestville Farmers Market, which takes place in Forestville's downtown park, this Tuesday, they are doing a pig roast. And they also have lots of other foods and special activities for the holiday, special foods for vegans and for vegetarians. I will be there. It's not far from Sebastopol, so it should be a really nice day. The other farmers market that vendors absolutely adore is the Cloverdale Farmers Market. Every vendor I know, Dennis Dunn, say, who is selling his brothers, Franco, his One World Sausages, Dora Lise, Handel, who sells a few things, everyone who goes to the Tuesday night market in Cloverdale talks about how it's such a great community with vendors who all enjoy each other and customers who come every week. So if you feel like a little road trip, you could head up to Cloverdale. If you hate the heat, make sure you check the temperature. Or there's the Forestville one with its pig roast on Tuesday. And Anthony, can you believe it? I talked all the way through.
That's quite the accomplishment. I would not be able to do that.
So there you go. Have a great holiday. Meet me back here next Sunday for another yummy episode of Mouthful, smart talk about food, wine, and farming here on KRCB 91.1 FM.
Grapes are covering the grassland. They're buying up for family farms. Selling out.